sick and tired of hearing things from uptight, short-sighted, narrow-minded hypocrites. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth. I've had enough of reading things by neurotic, psychotic, pig-headed politicians. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth.
Hello, listeners, and welcome to this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. Today you'll hear the second and final part of the speech given by Dahlia Wasfey at the Understanding Deep Politics Conference in Santa Cruz, California on May 15, 2010. Dahlia is a medical doctor who now dedicates much of her time to stopping the wars and occupations. Her website is liberatethis.com. I've heard her speak at three conferences this past year, and she's been interviewed on many radio shows and on Grit TV with Laura Flanders. Her father is Iraqi and her mother is Jewish. She was born in the U.S., so she has a very unique perspective on the Middle East, and she doesn't hold back anything. This part of the speech is approximately 28 minutes long, so let's get started. Here's Dahlia.
So it is joint American-Israeli operations that are occurring in Palestine and in Iraq, either directly or through funding. An article from December of 2003 in the British paper The Guardian, Israel trains U.S. assassination squads in Iraq. They have been conducting ethnic cleansing campaigns for 60 years now. So when we need help in eliminating opposition and resistance, we go to the Israelis for advice. The IDF has been sent to Fort Bragg, which is the home of American Special Forces, and Israeli military consultants have visited Iraq, which is extremely dicey, because even just for appearance purposes, but it's happened. And what they've done, if you watch what the U.S. troops are doing, it's the same thing that the Israeli troops are doing in occupied Palestine. Sealing off centers of resistance with razor wire, raising buildings from where attacks have been launched against U.S. troops. Another word for this? Collective punishment. Another group that did this? The Nazis. Amir Owen in Haaretz, one of the big Israeli dailies, back from 2005, America's SOS to the IDF. They needed help because IEDs were taking out a lot of American soldiers. And so they're like, well, what do you guys do when oppressing a poor brown population? And so the U.S. Army maintains frequent and regular contacts with the IDF. American officers travel to Israel for training, and some of the dogs that you may have seen in the Abu Ghraib photos might be from the IDF's canine unit, because it's a much shorter trip from Tel Aviv than from the United States. American crowd control in Iraq. I know from a contact of mine who served as an MP in Nasiriyah, her job was crowd control. What they used were concussion grenades, projectile beanbags, and rubber bullets. What do the Israelis use? Concussion grenades, projectile beanbags, and rubber bullets. They're not actually rubber bullets like you think of throwing a super bounce ball at somebody. These are rubber-coated steel bullets. And when lodged in a child's brain, they have the same effect as without that rubber coating. Israeli Mossad and commandos are in a heavily guarded base in northern Iraq. And this is the Mossad training the Kurdish forces. The Kurds, the Kurdish leadership, and the Israelis have long been allied. The Kurds seeking an independent state, which has always been problematic for us because it's the same ethnicity, whether they're in Turkey or whether they're in Iraq. But in Iraq, they're good Kurds, and in Turkey, they're bad Kurds. We decided. But they've been seeking independence. They thought the Israelis would help them. And the Israelis and the Americans have for a long time used the Kurds as like a fifth column opposing Saddam Hussein. And they were involved in the invasion in 2003. The name for the Kurdish militia, the major militia, is the Peshmerga. And this is the consulting. This is the training that the Israelis have done in Iraq through private military companies. There is an Israeli security firm called Interop that has two subsidiaries for Iraq work. Like Halliburton says, I didn't do anything. That's Kellogg, Brown, and Root. Well, y'all write the same checks. Those two subsidiaries were Kudo and Coliseum, which were Swiss registered. So it's all kosher, if you will. Danny Yatom, again, Mossad training Kurdish forces. Danny Yatom was the co-founder of that company, Interop, and was the chairman of it until 2003. He is also a former director of the Mossad, and he served in the Knesset from 2003 to 2008. So the same interchange between military and civilian and military and governing positions happens in Israel the same way it happens here. Now, why? Why would the Mossad be training Kurdish forces? And two big reasons. As I mentioned, they're longtime collaborators. They wanted the help of the Kurdish militias, the Peshmerga, with the invasion in 2003. The Americans wanted the help. And they moved south with U.S. forces as part of the invasion. The Peshmerga continued to occupy southern provinces, still north of Baghdad, but far south of what is today referred to as Kurdistan. And what has happened at the hands of the U.S. Army and the Kurdish militias working with them are human rights abuses against non-Kurdish Iraqis, be they Turkmen, Chaldeo-Assyrians, Armenian Christians, Shabaks, Yazidis, and Arabs, just to name a few. The government, through the media, broke it down for us as far as we could go. Three groups, Sunni, Shia, Kurd. Iraq is way more complicated, and they got thousands of years of history that we shouldn't even consider ourselves able to understand. You have to grow up in a particular neighborhood to understand the histories and the dynamics there. But what's clear is that in order to control northern Iraq, especially Kirkuk, is very oil rich, and we want control of that flow of oil. So we will support the people who could do that for us. So that's the major reason that Mossad has been training Kurdish forces. The other big reason is that it's strategic for hitting Iran, which was ultimately the Israeli goal. Now, if you look at this map, here's occupied Palestine, which is Israel, and here's Tehran. Oh, that's so far. That's a long, long way. Wouldn't it be easier if we could just stop here and refuel? Maybe rest overnight, come back here. So it's a staging ground for attacking Iran. But that works both ways. It works both ways because just as Iran is right next door to Iraq for the Israelis or the Americans to strike, Iraq is right next door to Iran. So if we hit Iran, Iran has 160,000 targets with American flags on their uniforms right next door. They don't have to come over here. They got it right next door, and they're there illegally. Israel has a national urban training center, again, establishing that it's joint American-Israeli operations. In the Marine Corps Times, an article from June of 2007, this urban training center, built by the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers. I don't know if the quality of the work is the same as the levees that failed with Hurricane Katrina, but it seems to be up and running, continue. This has been funded by U.S. military aid. This has been funded by your tax dollars. And in a later article from February of 2009, this was going to be a training area for U.S. Marines as well. So this is why we're the ones who make the distinction between the occupation of Iraq and the occupation of Palestine. The rest of the world has most of this information. But we tend to make the distinction, but we have to understand where our policies need to go, that it's one and the same. The IDF is training at that center for four theaters. This is, again, from the Military Times article, Marine Corps Times. Gaza, Lebanon, West Bank, and Syria. Illegal occupation. It's illegal to invade. Illegal occupation. Illegal occupation, the Golan Heights. It's all in violation of international law. And what the article said was that there was, this is 2007, there's a reasonable likelihood of another war on Israel's northern front, perhaps by summer's end, according to some intelligence estimates here. Well, in 2008, in December, we saw an assault not on the northern front, but on the people of Gaza in Operation Cast Lead. Now, at this urban training center, they have a cemetery that doubles as a soccer field, depending on the operational scenario. But what's critical about that and what's poignant to me about that is that in Iraq, there was a soccer field that had to be converted to a cemetery because every time the medical personnel went to go bury a body, they would get shot at by snipers. So instead of going to the graveyard that was on the outskirts of town in Fallujah, they used the soccer field to bury the dead. And many of those buried here are the kids who used to play in the soccer field. And you're going to see more of this at the end. Now, this right here, this image, this is Jalal Talabani, the president of Iraq under occupation. This is Mahmoud Abbas, still wheeling and dealing, though his term has long expired as a leader of the Palestinian Authority. And this is Ehud Barak, who was prime minister, but now serves as defense minister in Israel. I found this photo online, but I saw the newsreel when it was playing, showing this historic handshake. And I happened to be at my parents' house, and I was watching it with my father. And with compassion, he said, "This is the cause. What noble cause? This is the cause that Casey Sheehan died for. You won't see Saddam Hussein shaking this hand, and you won't see the leader of Hamas dealing with people who are responsible for war crimes and colonialism in the Arab world." The Mossad is conducting assassinations in Iraq. There was a conference in Madrid in April of 2006 outlining the more than 350 Iraqi scientists and more than 200 academics that have been murdered by Mossad, which is like Israeli Special Forces, CIA, and American forces. These are the academics, the nuclear scientists, the chemical scientists, the biological scientists that were first offered jobs to come work for American defense contractors. But if they refused American collaboration, they would be eliminated. Number one, you eliminate that level of education so the country can defend itself. And number two, you eliminate academics and intellectuals, and that's the category of people that can lead a resistance and resist the occupiers' policies. We've seen it happen before. In the 1960s, the CIA fed the names of leftist intellectuals and communists to a young upstart from Tikrit who wanted to come to leadership in Iraq. That's how Saddam Hussein's killing sprees started, is with the CIA's help. And the same thing is going on today to assassinate intellectuals in Iraq. Zionist influence guiding our foreign policy, it's not the only thing, but we have to take a look at the influence here and the financial incentives that are being given to our leadership in order to serve an interest that is not in our national security interest. Israel occupies, as I've mentioned, Palestine, Syria, Iraq, and for what's important to us, the United States Congress. Now, why do I say that? How do they do it? Money. Follow the money. Here's one example. Haim Saban, who in the 2001-2002 year was the largest single donor to the Democratic Party. Democrats are not going to help us unless you have $10 million to give to them. He has a $2 billion empire that he's built, and he built it through violence. His corporation is Saban Entertainment. One of the things he's put together is Mighty Morphin Power Rangers, but he also has ties to Fox News. So that's who's guiding our understanding. He also put forth some of his pocket change to establish the Saban Center for Middle East Policy at the Brookings Institution. The Brookings Institution is a conservative think tank that was a big cheerleader for invading Iraq. Haim Saban established Martin Indyk as the first director of the Saban Center, and he's well established as a Zionist neoconservative. Saban says, "I'm a one-issue guy, and my issue is Israel." Well, if you as an individual want to support 62 years of ethnic cleansing, maybe I can't change your mind. But I don't think it's fair that you get to use your money to guide American foreign policy that jeopardizes everybody over there and everybody over here. That's what I got a problem with. Another example of the influence in Congress is the influence of lobbies like APAC, the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee. And they give a lot of money to congressional representatives. There's a very good resource by former State Department official Richard Curtis. It's called Stealth PACs, Stealth Public Affairs Committee, Stealth PACs. So it's hidden how much influence various lobby groups have. Jeffrey Blankford, a journalist and Middle East analyst and someone of Jewish background, says that the reason that the pro-Israel lobby has to give so much more money to the politicians than the other lobbies, such as arm manufacturers, oil, etc., is that supporting Israel and Israel's policies is arguably not in the U.S. interest from any perspective, and the contributions are necessary to buy the politicians' cooperation. So Zionist influence on American policy, it was the Zionist neoconservatives who pushed for invading Iraq, and those same people continue to push for invading Iran. Mearsheimer and Walt came out with their landmark book, The Israel Lobby in U.S. Foreign Policy. As I mentioned, Israel really was targeting Iran from the beginning, but we convinced them to work with us to attack Iraq. And the same neocons who pushed for invading Iraq, Feith and Wormser, are pushing for a military assault on Iran. Now, why doesn't Israel just go ahead? You know, if you really want to hit them that bad, just go ahead. Well, they need help. And when I read this, I was like, what the? Come on, this is not democracy. The Israelis need U.S. permission to use Iraqi airspace. There's sovereignty for you. But they have to. If you remember the map, you're going to fly over a few countries there, and Saddam Hussein was not going to give them permission to use his airspace. The other, and maybe the more important thing, is that the Israelis need the U.S. Air Force. You may remember the map. Iran is a big country, 70 million people. And as I mentioned, Iran can hit right back, right next door. So if America has a stake in it, then the biggest military superpower in the world might do more damage than the Israelis can on their own. This is an article from Chris Hedges that appeared in February 2009. Everything I have here today is at my website, liberatethis.com, under a section called Further Reading. But I have to back up what I say because it's so vastly different from what we usually hear. Of course, here's our commander-in-chief now. And I think, finally, the magic spell is wearing off. I didn't make this. I got this off of Facebook, but I love it. And the magic spell is wearing off, and people are starting to see that, you know, oh, he's not the Messiah that we hoped he'd be. But there is a myth that relations with Israel have gotten worse. But actually, while for us it might be better in the Bahamas, for Israel, it's better with the Obamas. Michael Oren, Israeli ambassador to the U.S., has praised the Obama response to lost ground during the close of the Bush years, and that this change in his policy was warm and immediate. And this was to maintain a qualitative military edge. There is no other country for whom we are interested in maintaining a qualitative military edge. And so we've been giving Israel cutting-edge technology to give Israel a larger margin of safety. This is from the Jewish Daily Forward. The United States' commitment to Israel's QME has been now codified directly into U.S. law through a 2008 piece of legislation backed by AIPAC. This stuff gets just like hidden. It just slides under the radar. And so now this requires the president, now Obama, to report to Congress periodically on actions taken by the administration to ensure Israel's qualitative military edge. If only we had such legislation to regulate Goldman Sachs. So far, there's been one such report, but everything is classified. I don't know what's in it. They've had increased cooperation on missile defense. In November of 2009, 7 months ago, there was a joint American-Israeli exercise called Juniper Cobra. You can do a search for Juniper Cobra. This has been the biggest missile defense dry run ever that involved 1,400 U.S. servicemen, probably at the training center that the Army Corps of Engineers built in Israel. What are they practicing for? We are now selling, it should happen this year if it hasn't already, F-35 fighter jets. Now, I don't know that much military technology, but if F-15s and F-16s are super sophisticated, I'm guessing that the F-35 is really beyond that. So what we need to think of while we're giving this qualitative military edge away, what are they going to do with the weapons? And would they ever harm us? Oh, yes. And it's documented. False flag attack. The USS Liberty, June 8th, 1967. I'm going to offer you just a brief mention of it here, but there's an excellent BBC documentary called Dead in the Water that I highly recommend to everybody. Israel attacked the USS Liberty. It was an attack on the Navy and the Marines. It was an aerial bombing attack, and then Israeli ships came in and torpedoed the vessel. An order from Johnson came down for the 6th Fleet that was supposed to protect the Liberty, which was an unarmed spy ship. The 6th Fleet was told to stand down. Stand down. Stand down orders. I saw the flag, which had visibly identified the ship as American, riddled with bullet holes, and heard testimony that made it clear that the Israelis intended there be no survivors. 34 were killed, over 100 injured. The survivors are still out there seeking justice. Ron Kukol, who was in charge of body recovery and identification, he has stories to tell, K-U-K-A-L. This is still out there, and they are still seeking justice. So that's the USS Liberty is a critical moment. Israel charged with systemic harassment of U.S. Marines. This is an article that came out in March of 1995, reported by Donald Neff. In Lebanon in 1983, Reagan had put Marines in Lebanon. And what the Israelis wanted to do is they wanted the Marines to work for them. And the Marines didn't want to because they didn't want to be associated. They were supposed to be there as a peacekeeping force, so they didn't want to take sides. But this is an important article regarding the harassment of American forces by Israeli forces. And of course, we know the outcome. Ultimately, the Lebanese caught on that the U.S. was taking sides, and 283 Marines were killed when their barracks were blown up. Another incident, Rachel Corey, and this one is near and dear to my heart. I never knew Rachel, just knew of her story that came along at an important point in my life. But Rachel was a 23-year-old college student whose response to 9/11 was to find out what was going on in the world because the media spin just didn't seem right to her. And what she ended up doing in 2003 was she went as a volunteer with the International Solidarity Movement, which goes and practices civil disobedience, nonviolent civil disobedience in the occupied territories, trying to enforce international law. And on March 16, 2003, she and five of her colleagues were standing down bulldozers, tax-free gifts from you and me to the Israeli army in its ethnic cleansing campaigns, all illegal. The standoff took over 3.5 hours, and she succeeded, and her colleagues succeeded, in deterring the first bulldozer. But a second bulldozer came, and obviously, Rachel, you can see her in her fluorescent jacket with a bullhorn, and according to the eyewitnesses, easily visible to the two operators of the Caterpillar D9 bulldozer. But she was mowed down. The drivers of the bulldozer went over her, kept their blade down, and backed up over her. And when her friends got to her, she said, "My back is broken," and those were her last words. So Rachel died that day. She knew what was going on. She knew the racism that was going on. And in her letters to her parents, she said, you know, if the Israelis ever change what they're doing and they direct harm towards someone white like me, I want you to know this. But Rachel could have turned a blind eye to the horrors of the world. She's an all-American girl, blonde, blue-eyed, beautiful, could have lived the American dream. And she chose to go thousands of miles away to help people she didn't know. Her only connection to them was humanity, which is really what I think is the key that outshines everything else. And she literally stood up for what she believed in. And so she was critical to my decision to start standing up and opening my mouth because I had a lot at stake. Never fails that I get choked up talking about Rachel. Rachel died that day. Her parents just finished their phase of the civil case. They are still seeking justice for Rachel's murder, and the case is ongoing, but you can find out more at the RachelCoreyFoundation.org. So absolutely, Israelis, after that, it was open season on internationals in the occupied territories. Tom Herndl was shot and killed. Brian Avery was shot in the face. And more recently, Tristan Anderson was shot in the head with a high-velocity tear gas canister. And there are others I'm not mentioning. And of course, Palestinians and Iraqis are dying every day. I'm probably invoking the same racism that I've been taught, that everybody's been taught, that Western lives are more important. But what stands out for these individuals is that, you know, the way I look, I feel like I have an obligation to do what I do. As I said, those are individuals who could turn a blind eye and not pay attention, but they wanted to do something. Rachel's story was buried because 3 days later is bad PR, and 3 days later, shock and awe started. Just to point out, total direct American aid to Israel from 1949 to 2008, over $113 billion. What could you do with $113 billion? They are the largest total recipient of aid since World War II, and there was an agreement signed in 2007, that 10-year, $30 billion aid package, ongoing, average of $3 billion a year over a 10-year period. What's important is we don't just give Israel that much money. They get special benefits that nobody else does. All the economic and military aid is given in cash during the first month of the fiscal year. Take it. No accounting required. Do whatever you want with it. Israel is the only country allowed to deal directly with U.S. companies. Every other country who buys from American defense weapons manufacturers has to go through the Department of Defense so that we know exactly what they're getting. Israel, go ahead. Do whatever you want. And only Israel is allowed to spend 26% of each year's military aid in Israel, with Israeli weapons manufacturers, which means that we have financed a very sophisticated Israeli defense industry, that Israel is today the eighth leading world supplier of arms as of 2007. So what is it that they need the $3 billion a year for? At this point, they have a sophisticated industry on their own. What's happening is that there was some economic aid, some military aid. The economic aid is decreasing. The military aid is increasing. And our tax dollars are subsidizing, as I mentioned, one of the most powerful militaries in the world. An excellent resource, ifamericansknew.org. It's at my site. Just a small sampling. Between 2000 and 2005, M109 spare parts and artillery shells used to shell the beaches in Gaza. Almost $70,000 for that five-year period. I could have used that to pay for part of my education. Tanks, components, and spare parts, $348 million. Maybe the people of New Orleans could have used that. Patrol boat, ships, submarine components, and spare parts, torpedoes, and sonar equipment, $572 million. That would be a nice platform for towards a healthcare system. And spare parts, engines, missiles for F-15, F-16 fighter planes, $1 billion between 2000 and 2005. In 2005, the Veterans Affairs budget came up $1 billion short. So what this is this is military financing that is in gross violation of international law, the Geneva Conventions. It is in gross violation of our domestic laws, including the U.S. Arms Export Control Act, which says that we won't deal arms with governments that attack civilians. The war on terror is a war of terror and a war of illegality. We and Israel used napalm, white phosphorus, depleted uranium, cluster bombs, experimental weapons. A lot of the new weapons that are manufactured in this country get tried out in Iraq and Palestine. House raids, the uprooting of trees, the building of a wall, it's the same occupation. This was an ambulance in Fallujah. This was an ambulance in Lebanon. This big red mark on the top of the ambulance is not X marks the spot. That's a Red Cross ambulance. But as you can see, that's a direct hit on a centered target right outside the Lebanese Red Cross. Can you imagine what would happen if any other country or a Muslim country did that to a Red Cross ambulance? Oh, my Lord. No consequences. We bomb bridges. This is from the Gulf War in 1991. The Israelis bomb bridges. Everybody flee the cities. And then we bomb the bridges so there's no escape. And so we have people who don't like us. This no random arrests, detainees have legal and human rights. Who is the terrorist? You, USA, terrorist to the world. And in Lebanon, they know what Condoleezza is doing. They're not impressed by her piano playing. Nice bombs, nice gifts to our children. Thank you for the smart bombs from Kana's children. They know exactly what's going on. In March of 2010, a fundraiser was held for the Israeli forces, $1,000 a plate at the Waldorf Astoria in New York City. Special honored guest, Gabby Ashkenazi, chief of the IDF General Staff, who has a long list of degrees from American universities. He was one of the leaders of Operation Cast Lead in Gaza. If you're worried about terrorists getting visas to come to this country, and if you're worried about foreigners breaching the borders, this should be a red flag. This is the kind of person you don't want to be associated with. So, ultimately, what we have to do, just in that part of the world, obviously, I have a personal connection, so I'm focused here, but these issues are in our own cities, and they're in our history all over the world. We need to end the entire occupation. In my world, in my life, I know two anti-war Cindys, Cindy Sheehan and Cindy Corey. Cindy and Craig Corey were Rachel's parents, and they are both seeking justice for American policy, and they both lost their children to American foreign policy. What we have to do is just get out. We don't want anybody else interfering with what we do here, and they certainly don't want us meddling with our money and our weapons and our armed forces. I am calling for cutting military aid to Israel in compliance with domestic and international law. That's it. I just want us to follow the law. That's it. If we want national security, we have to stop denying it for others. I believe that the American people as a whole, given the facts, would make the right decisions. So again, I just want to emphasize what a tremendous honor it's been to share this podium with so many distinguished speakers. And thank you for sharing your time and having me here today. Thank you so much.
You've just been listening to the conclusion of the speech given by Dahlia Wasfi at the Understanding Deep Politics Conference in Santa Cruz, California, on May 15th, 2010. This concludes this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. Thanks for listening.